This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod staff. With me today, I have Mr. Mark Mears. So Mark is an author and purpose-driven leadership expert who spearheaded growth at global companies such as McDonald's, PepsiCo, and the Cheesecake Factory to champion a human-centric growth. His transformative love framework in his new book, Love at Work, empowers leaders to move beyond traditional management and cultivate a culture of genuine belonging. So Mark, thank you for being here. I really appreciate having you on.
Thank you, Michael. It's my honor.
Awesome. Well, to get started, just can you tell us a little bit about the book? I know that the book is kind of where you're spending a lot of your time now, book promotion and things like that. So I want to just kind of get the rundown of the book and have our listeners be able to kind of dive into it on this podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And it's been a labor of love, literally and figuratively. And the book's called Love at Work. It's about creating communities of purpose and belonging for revolutionary growth in this new world of work. And it came to me as an epiphany a couple years ago. I had launched my first book, The Purposeful Growth Revolution, and that was fall of 2022, and was busy promoting it. And I have a monthly LinkedIn newsletter. I hope you're your listeners and viewers will subscribe. It's called Seeds for Growth. And it was February a few years ago, and I always try to be relevant, seasonally relevant, and relevant to the the time and what's going on in the world. And so I was trying to think of what should I write that month? And I thought, well, February is Valentine's Day. It's kind of the season of love. And so I wrote down on a pad of paper that I keep handy always, and I just wrote down love. And it was there in that moment, Michael, I got this epiphany and I just wrote, L is for listen, O is for observe, V is for value, and E is for empower. And I got to thinking, well, those are four fundamental human needs we all share, but often don't experience in the workplace. And so I started building this out a little bit, writing this article and getting research that supported the thesis. And I got a ton of not only impressions, but actual engagement, comments and shares of people saying, Mark, this is so timely. It's so relevant. And I thought, well, this is great. And so I put it away and kept promoting my first book. And February rolled around again. And I had received even more research, more support for this thesis. So I added that to that construct. And I got even more impressions, more engagement, more comments, even more encouraging saying, Mark, this should be your second book. And I'm like, oh no, I've written my first book. I didn't even know I was going to finish that. I'm not an author, no. And so I kind of put it away again for a while. And then that fall with even more research, it hit my heart just like the first book. It nudged me to say, yep, I think it's time you should turn this into a book. So I started working on it. And then in January of a year ago, I officially declared 2025 as the official year of love. And I cited all the reasons for it. Little did I know what was going to happen in 2025 with the election cycle and all that went on in the world last year. But I used that year to really kind of pin my ears back and get this book done by late last fall. And I'm happy to report it also hit bestseller status on Amazon, and this time three different categories. So I know it's timely. I know it's relevant. And so I created an assessment tool that's on my website at markamears.com, and you've taken it. And it provides an opportunity that follows the four love leadership model components: listen, observe, value, and empower. Where listen, how do you listen? You want to listen graciously. Why? To build trust with your teammates. Like any good relationship, it has to be founded on trust. And then I said, observe, well, how? Generously, to invest in your teammates, making them feel like you believe in them. And then value, gratefully, to appreciate your teammates, not as workers or employees, but as whole people, right? Whole persons. So they feel personally valued and appreciated. And then empower them to grow into their full potential and not only at work, but in life. And I got to thinking, if we could score that, we could create kind of a love gap framework where the leader would take it as if they're perceiving themselves in each of these different areas, and teammates could take it as if they're actually experiencing it. And then we could see, where are there gaps that maybe I can help through my book and through different trainings to close the gap, to create a more humanistic, more purposeful, more collaborative leadership approach that transforms us from the tired, old, hierarchical command and control management style that no longer serves us. I want to put the human back in human resources. And I say, to do so, all we need is love.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think one of the first things you said was about the book was the timing of it. And I think you couldn't have nailed it better, because we had spoken about this briefly, and you mentioned it in the book, even in the intro, about how this, you know, the younger generation is asking questions. Like, my generation is not only saying, yes, sir, but we're saying, yes, sir, why? Like, yeah. Why am I doing this? And I think that command and control aspect, while it's still around, you know, I actually just experienced it. I took your assessment, and I think, what did I score? 31 for a previous leader that I had in my career. And it was just kind of an eye-opening experience to, basically kind of rehash that in my mind of like, wow, now that I'm putting it into bullet points and questions and a score on your assessment, it's very eye-opening to how bad a situation is, but you don't realize it fully until you remove yourself and evaluate the situation through an assessment or something. So while, yes, the assessment took not very long, took me a couple of minutes, it was incredibly helpful in evaluating that I'm really glad I got out of a bad situation when I did.
Yeah, when I saw your scores come across, I thought, man, I feel sorry for Michael. And so good that you recognized it as a toxic work environment and said, it's not going to get better, so I need to leave it. Well, guess what? That's what's going on in companies all over not only America, but the world. So Gallup does their annual State of the Global Workplace report each year. And they just published a couple of weeks ago the 2026 report. And it suggests that engagement is continuing to decline, and they could monetize it by saying roughly $10 trillion, with a T, dollars are being wasted through lack of engagement in the workplace, which equates to roughly 9% of global GDP. And so that's a big shock and awe number, right? You're like, well, how does that apply to my workplace? Then I found another source that says, on a granular level, 34% of every dollar of compensation given to an employee, I say teammate, but if someone's treated like an employee, then that's how they're treated. And we'll talk about the importance that words matter. But 34% is wasted. A third of a person you're paying for through lack of engagement isn't doing as high a quality of work, not as productive, not as engaged, doesn't have a sense of ownership in the outcome, and it's probably got one foot out the door. Because Gallup goes on to say that 52% of employees are actively looking for another job. Now, what gets scarier is they stated in this year's report, they looked into where is the largest source of disengagement coming from. It's coming from managers. So how, if I'm a teammate who doesn't want to be managed and required. I want to be led and inspired. If my manager isn't inspired and isn't leading and isn't engaged, how am I expected to do likewise? So when you talk about being timely and relevant, it is. And to be really clear, when I talk about this to some people, they're like, well, Mark, there's probably some, you know, executives out there that, you know, maybe like me or at a certain age that are so hardwired in their management style, where it is salute and execute, right? They're not going to read your book, or they're not going to be changed. They're going to continue to act like they have always done, because that's the way they've always done it. And that's the way it was done when they were coming up. And I say to that, you're right. There's sometimes you can't teach old dogs new tricks, but those that are willing to be humble and go through a process to allow themselves to be vulnerable, to learn what maybe they don't know. And here's what I'll tell you, Michael, is you don't need an MBA to do this, right? You just need to be human. So all I know is until the robots or the zombies or maybe ChatGPT takes us away, we're all still humans, and we still have that need to feel seen and heard, valued for who we are, and empowered to grow into our full potential. And so now more than ever, with the rise of technology, and we'll talk a little bit about the two AIs in a minute, but with, you know, artificial intelligence being one of them, and people in fear of or actually losing their jobs due to technological advancements that are supposed to make us more productive and provide higher quality output of work, we still need to have the human be the leader in the human resources process. And to be real clear, I'm not saying this is an HR issue. This is a leader issue. So as a leader who has spent nearly 40 years in business and over 20 of them in a C-level capacity, I've seen a lot. I've experienced a lot. And the good, the bad, and the ugly, by the way. I've had some tremendous mentors who have walked alongside me, who've invested in me, and who gave me hope and allowed me to experience them and then fold in the parts that I really admired into my own leadership style. And I've also had some stinkers who were truly bosses. And I say words matter. And the person that you worked for was not a leader at all. They were a boss. And I've had a few of them to where I'm saying, I admire some of what they stand for, but I'm going to leave some of the other stuff as baggage at the door to then cultivate my own leadership approach. And quite frankly, inspired me to write this book because I saw how it can be done. And I know that I don't have all the answers, but what I am pretty good at, not too many things, Michael, but visionary to be able to see patterns and possibilities and connect dots and take complexity and turn it into something that's a clear framework that people can follow. And that's what I did with this love leadership model. Listen, observe, value, and empower.
Yeah, well, first off, stinker is a very kind word. but second off, yeah, I totally agree with the taking something complex. You know, everything you just mentioned, it's a lot to unpack, or it can seem like it is. But I think the way I like to view things and the way I have to view things in order to not get overwhelmed and to like actually be productive and engaged and stuff like that is view things in increments and view things in simple forms. So the complexities, you know, I feel like that's when you've got to take it in increments and kind of pace yourself almost, or just simplify the entire thing. So what are your thoughts on that with your framework?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I built it based on researching. I believe in the higher power of fours, and I talk about that in my first book, The Purposeful Growth Revolution. Some people, you know, live by the rule of threes, and I used to, but now I believe in the higher power of fours because I thought, well, there's four seasons, not three. There's four directions, not three. There's four chambers to the human heart, not three. There's four elements to the atom, the source of life, not three. And I could go on and on with this foreplay, but you get where I'm going. So, and I also believe in models. And so I look at a four circle Venn diagram, and I got that because look at our four seasons, right? It may be March 21st is the first day of spring, and it may feel like it in Florida or California, but in the Midwest where I'm, you know, from, Kansas City, it oftentimes isn't feeling very spring-like. So there's an overlap. And I don't believe life is linear. So think of it as a four-circle Venn diagram, right? And so listen, observe, value, and empower. I tell you that you want to listen graciously to build trust with your teammates, and then observe generously to invest in your teammates, and valuing gratefully to appreciate your teammates, and empowering generatively to grow your teammates. Well, what are the four ways in each of those areas? And I researched and I came up with, for example, I'm not going to go through all of them, but let's break down listen, right? That's the foundation. You think about it as almost like a pyramid. The foundation of any relationship is listening, right? And building trust. So how do we listen? We listen actively. We're leaning in. We're focused. We're not looking at our watch. We're not looking at the wall or something else. We're locked in. We're using words and playing back. Here's what I heard you say. And that person feels listened to. And then we're listening with empathy. Sometimes a teammate's going through something. And, you know, if I built trust, they're going to tell me, you know, hey, Mark, there's a reason I have to leave at 4. My mom is transitioning into assisted living facility and I've got to be there. And I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't know that. Well, we're going to figure out how we can work around that. But is there anything I can do to help support you? And there may not be, but that person felt my empathy. And that trust just continues to build. And we also need to listen for understanding, right? I want clarity out of this conversation. Am I really listening, to your point of view and really soaking it in? And so I can be clear where you stand? Or am I just kind of waiting until you finish so I can kind of fire back my own thoughts, right? So if we're listening for understanding, we're trying to get clarity among each other. Where do we stand? And then if we're listening on those three levels, what do we now have to do? Well, I have to be responsive, right? So now I need to respond back to you in a way that makes you feel heard, understood with clarity, with a sense of empathy, if it's called for. And that way we have this trust that continues to build through listening. That allows us to then say, okay, now within the observe model, what are the four ways? And I have four there and value four there and empower four there. And so when you break it down to your point, it's not that daunting, right? But you're not going to get really great at it all at once. You need to focus. And I would say start with listening. And then I'd say looking at observing, but in all cases, looking to value that teammate, make them feel appreciated as a whole person just by the way you treat them. We're not talking about necessarily reward and recognition. And you see my love at work coffee mug. And instead of, you know, Michael's doing a great job, you know, let's give him a coffee mug or, you know, a tote bag or a drink vessel. But listening to say what really lights Michael up. What are his interests, not only at work, but outside of work? Because I want to value you as a whole person. You're not just someone who's a 9-to-5er to me. You're a whole person. You may have, a family, or maybe you're in a relationship, or maybe there's a certain sport that you like. You're a golfer, or you play tennis, or whatever. You love live music. But I learned that about you. So then when a major project is completed, again, instead of giving you the coffee mug, I'm giving you tickets to a ball game or to a concert, something that you can say, he really listens to me. He values me because he knows what my interest is, and I feel that I'm appreciated, right? So breaking it down in those ways, it's not so daunting. The book, you know, is fairly thick, but it's written in a style that makes you feel that I'm talking with you, not at you. And I use bigger type because I'm an old guy, and I make it kind of airy. I use diagrams. I insert quotes. So it's designed to be a curated reading experience and one that, you know, it's not just a one and done. You're going to read it and throw it somewhere. You're going to want to come back to it. And there's a lot of depth to it, so you're going to want to come back to it from time to time.
Yeah, and I can attest to that. It's been the book that's on my nightstand now. I brought it in here for the podcast, but I haven't finished it yet. But it certainly is just as a pretty simple read in terms of, like you said, complexity and breaking everything down, and kind of just what you described, really. I want to touch a little on the empathy piece that you mentioned in the breakdown, because everything else, I feel like, follows that empathy. If the empathy is there, then you do the other stuff decently, and I think it works out. What I've seen a lot, and I'm sure you've seen this even more, is leaders who say the right thing, the empathetic thing comes out of their mouth, and they don't have the empathy in their heart. And I think that a lot of times people think that others can't see that, but for me, I've been on the leadership end. I've led a couple of teams, and then I've been on the employee end where I'm a sales rep or an account executive. And I think that it's very eye-opening to see not only leaders not respond in the way that you would like them to with empathy, but also employees that I've been teammates with and stuff like that, and even some of my employees not responding well to empathy. Like, they're just like, I'm good. I don't want to, all this emotion and stuff like that. So I just feel like that's a really hard line to tiptoe. So what do you think about that?
There's some people that say, Mark, we say don't bring that weak crap in here. Keep your nose to the grindstone, get your job done, come in tomorrow and do it all again, and so on and so forth, right? And that was a lot of what I experienced when I was young in my career, because that was the way it kind of, it was. And we didn't have alternatives, so we suffered through it, right? But again, we're all humans. We all have a heart. We all have feelings, right? And so the idea of empathy, if someone is faking it, then it's going to boomerang on them. That's not going to build trust, right? So you have to be authentic. And you have to be human, right? And if you look at someone as just a person who's going to do a job that's going to make me look good or help me get promoted, that's not going to last. Because again, young people today, and you are one, and all the research I've seen, millennials and Gen Z, 89%, according to a study, said they want purpose in their work, not just in their life. They want to feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves, that they're not just punching in a clock and getting paid every other week. They want to feel like the company they work for shares their values. And if they say, oh, we represent X, Y, and Z values, and then they don't act it, that is why people are tuning out and disengaging, because it's not authentic. And that's why you see the low engagement levels that Gallup talks about. Quiet quitting, as we have heard it now, it's quiet cracking, given the mental health issues that are associated with fear, with stress, with anxiety, with burnout, right? And now we're hearing job hugging, because now the job market's turned, and the pendulum has swung in more toward the employer than the employee, and they need the job, so they're hugging that job, but they're not satisfied. They wish they were somewhere else, and so they're disengaged. So none of those three terms are good, right? And so if a leader is authentic and real and truly cares, I had an old leader of mine years and years ago, and I'm sure you and your listeners have probably heard this phrase, but for me, when I was kind of young and coming up in my career, it was the first time where I heard it. But this guy said, hey, Mark, you are a pretty smart guy. But I'm going to tell you, with your teammates, before they care how much you know, they need to know how much you care. And that stuck with me for the rest of my career, because I realized I was seeing people as transactional and not relational. I saw them as being on a team that was designed to help us collectively achieve our numbers, but for selfish reasons, maybe to help me get promoted.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
it
And that's
really got to
been.
my heart. And I said, I don't want to be that guy like others that I'd seen in that realm, and his, you know, mentoring to me, telling me what I needed to hear, whether I wanted to hear or not, made all the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate to that. I had a leader, same one I had mentioned earlier, same kind of just bad situation that I had, had said to me one time, point blank, you can almost appreciate the honesty, though. Michael, your value to me in this company is how much money you bring in. So, you know, sit in your seat and do what I tell you.
Yeah.
And that just blew my mind. And I've always been told a little bit that that since I ask questions and stuff, like, Michael, you're not like the greatest, easiest employee to deal with. But you do well. You know, you always, you know, we always find a way, and you do well. And looking back on even that conversation, that was from someone who definitely loved and cared about me, I think, in the workplace. But even that, since there was a difference in generation, they were, I think, honestly confused as to why a Gen Zer would say, why are we doing this, though? We've done the same thing last week, and we're trying to do the same thing, just in a different light. We know it didn't work. And, like, that kind of thought process is very prevalent around my generation. And I think everyone's thinking it. Not everyone. Most people are thinking it. But very few speak up. So the ones that do speak up to the older generations that are the command and controllers, I just find that it stumps them. And a lot of times they end up respecting you a little bit more if they're decent and empathetic. Yeah. But they just are getting used to the younger generation saying, I don't really care that much about your title. I still have a question for you as to why.
Yeah, and you're just saying what I'm seeing in all the research. You know, younger generations, they don't want to be managed and required. They want to be led and inspired, and they want to be part of the conversation, right? Even though they're junior. And when I was coming up, and if I was invited to a meeting, I was pretty much told point blank, keep your mouth shut, listen, take good notes, learn, but for whatever reason, you know, don't speak up. And so we were all tamped down and had value we could be offering. But we were basically told, you know, there's a hierarchy, there's a caste system, and, you know, and you never could go around your immediate supervisor to a higher. That was like forbidden. You'd be thrown out the door. So there was this kind of hierarchical caste system that everybody kind of fell in line, and like lemmings, we all jumped off a cliff and followed it. But young people today, they're like, no, I want to know what's going on and why. They want more transparency. I want to know if these are our sales goals, where are they coming from? How are we going to hit them? And how am I doing? And how am I doing reflective to or comparative to someone else? And what are they doing that I can learn from? Or what can I teach somebody else to? They want more collaboration. They want to be part of the conversation. And I think that's great.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just like genuine curiosity, at least on my end. Like, everything you're saying right now is almost very, I would say it's actually very validating to me, because these are the conversations that I lived with, like, day in and day out, that, you know, throughout my sales career. And at the same time, like, hearing it back, it does make you think, wow, the generation has a genuine curiosity. It's not so much like at least for me and the people that, you know, I was around as teammates, it's not so much I need to be in charge, it's I need to be in the loop.
Yes. And I have maybe something to add to the discussion. And that's where we get into this idea of AI. And I like to say the other AI. For those of a certain age, back in the 1980s, there was a whole commercial ad campaign by the National Pork Council. And they would compare themselves against chicken. And they would say, you know, pork, the other white meat. So there's another AI versus just artificial intelligence that I want to make sure people are aware of. And that's appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry has been around also since about the 1980s. But the whole idea is that it's designed to make it more collaborative. So in meetings, you're collaborating, and ideas are bubbling up from the bottom up, not the, you know, top down. Hey, we went to a 3-day offsite with the management team, and we've come back with our goals for the year, and here's what they are, and you're just going to go do them. Now it's more of a, you know, idea of getting people involved in the process and having the ideas bubble up. And now you're feeling like you're invested in the outcome because you had a say, right? And so there's a magic to orchestrating questions that get at the key issues that then lead to growth solutions. So to your point, we don't just put lipstick on a pig and say, well, we did it this way, now we're going to do it a little bit different. And you know, as Einstein famously was quoted, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, right? But where are the new ideas going to come from? They may come from younger people who say, hey, I've looked at it this way, and it's maybe a little bit different. And while it might not be the exact right solution, it may spark an idea that then could lead to the exact right solution, and you feel good that you were part of that solution versus having it all handed down to you and force-fed and, you know, treated like all you are, to your point, Michael. And when you told me that story, it broke my heart. Your value to this company and me is the sales results that you get and nothing more. Yeah. How that's like prehistoric dinosaur kind of thinking. Yeah. Right. And so there are some old dogs who aren't going to learn new tricks. They are going to die off like dinosaurs. They're just going to retire. But when I created my first book, The Purposeful Growth Revolution, I thought, well, I'm a purpose guy. I really believe in purpose. And so I thought, oh, I better write my own purpose statement. What do I really stand for? And I said, I don't want to just make money and retire. I want to make a difference and inspire. And that means making a difference in the lives of others and inspiring them to want to do likewise. So it creates this virtuous cycle of reciprocity, or what I call paying it backward. And I call it paying it backward. People say, well, Mark, you're a big believer that words matter. Isn't the phrase pay it forward? And I said, well, no, the way I see it is I'm a big, you know, coffee junkie, right? So I love Starbucks. And so when I go to Starbucks through the drive-through, I will pay for the car behind me. I can't pay for the car in front of me because they've already driven off, right? So I get up to the window and I tell the barista, hey, I'd like to pay for the car behind me. And they say, oh, that's so nice of you. And I said, well, can you just do me one favor? And they said, what? I said, just tell them, God bless you, your debt has been paid. And they get a smile on their face. Absolutely. Have a great day. And I drive off and I say a silent prayer for that person or persons in the car. They don't know me. I don't know them. But I got to believe in that moment, they feel valued. They feel seen and blessed, right? Literally and figuratively, not only with the cup of coffee or whatever else they bought, but to have someone say, God bless you, your debt has been paid, right? And so the chain reaction happens where I've been told that people pay for the car behind them and the car behind them, because there is something called the law of reciprocity, which states that if someone does something nice for you, you feel a deep-seated urge to do something nice for somebody else, and sometimes in greater measure. So the idea is, I don't want to just make money and retire. I've had a wonderful career, and I could just take it to my grave and go out and play golf or do whatever, right? But I felt the urge to want to pay it backward and help others along their growth journey and demonstrate that an old dog can learn new tricks and can show up different. And be the kind of leader we all wish we worked for. And so that's what gets me up in the morning every single day, is this idea of, how do I pay it backward? Who can I bless today? And maybe who can bless me? And so we can continue to grow and learn from each other for as many days, months, years I may have left.
Yeah, that's, you know, I just wish that, you could give a speech to every leader between the age of 32 and 60 and kind of have them replicate that. Because I think things would change, really. I really do. And what came up for me as you were speaking is, I had a podcast episode with someone who was about my age, maybe a little older. He had just started a business, you know, around the time that I was starting mine. And but his was, you know, very established in terms of like the financial acumen that he had. And we were talking on the podcast about how the age, we focus too much on the age, because the older generation says, well, you know, I'm this age, so I have these skills and I have this capability. And that in turn can make people that are younger say, well, yeah, I mean, I'm only 27, so when I'm 32, I might be able to do that kind of thing, you know. But I think that's the most poisonous mindset that you can have, and that kind of just ties in with everything and that you've talked about. And then even the paying it backward, like the leaders that are, you know, 60 and say, you know, I'm this age, so I can do this. They should be saying, let me pay it backward to the guy who has a little bit of broken confidence because he's been told that he can only do so much because he's only at this level or at this age.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. There's a whole section in my book where I talk about the fact is we're nearing a time when there'll be six generations in the workplace at the same time. And maybe you've heard the term reverse mentoring, and it's so important where, you know, you grew up with in a digital age, right? Versus someone like myself. When I went to college at the University of Kansas, I took computer science, and back then you had to write, you know, I took Fortran because I didn't know it was the engineering weed out course instead of COBOL, which was more business school. But anyway, I got into this Fortran class, one of the hardest classes I've ever done, because that's just that kind of, you know, just not my skill set. And then a couple of years later, but I took it because you could get out of a foreign language. So I'm like, well, two semesters of computer science versus four of a foreign language. I may never use the foreign language, but I'll for sure use computer skills because computers are going to be the wave of the future. Well, I was right. But a couple of years later, a guy named Bill Gates creates a personal computer, and he's done all the coding and stuff for you. And I'm like, oh. So anyway, the point is just that you come up from this digital age and you're a digital native where I'm learning it, right? And I'm not as proficient as you are. I can learn from you in areas that you're better than me, right? And you're going to add value by teaching me things that you know that's going to help enhance my, you know, tools in my toolbox, right? But that comes with humility and being able to say, and I'm not expert at this. I'm pretty good at this and this and this. And over the years, I've learned to be better at this, this, and this. But there's certain things I'm not there yet. My brain's not wired that way, but yours is. Can you teach me how to do X, Y, and Z? Now, all of a sudden, Michael, you feel valued. Like, you have skills at even a young age that can help not only me, but our team get better, our organization get better. And so why wouldn't we want cross-generational mentoring, right? And so I'm a big believer in that. And again, I'm old enough to, know what I don't know, where my interests in and where my interests are not. But I also know to be a truly well-rounded leader, I don't have to be expert, but I'd have to know enough to be dangerous if I'm going to lead, right? And so in me, with my marketing background, when digital marketing became, you know, much bigger part of the marketing, you know, pie, I had to learn from younger people. I had to humble myself and be a student and ask questions. But you know what it did? It made them feel like I was a real person. I was, you know, humble and willing to learn from anybody. And don't you know that has a ripple effect when that becomes their turn to lead? And that's what I say. A legacy builder is someone who not only someone says, I will follow you if you're a leader, I will obey you if you're a boss, but if you are a leader that I truly trust and admire and we've built a relationship, when it's my turn to lead, I'll lead like you, if not better. And so now you're creating a ripple effect with this idea of, you know, paying it backward. Let's say I have four or five direct reports on my team. If I am inspiring them as a leader to want to follow me, not just because they have to, because I have a higher title and I'm a box that's higher than them on the org chart, but because we've built this relationship where there is trust, There is a sense that they feel invested in. They do feel appreciated. They do feel like they have the opportunity to grow into their full potential, which are the outcomes of the four love leadership model components, right? They're then going to say, when it's my turn to lead, I'll lead like you. So now those four or five direct reports, we've now created four or five more pebbles to throw in the pond and more ripple effects that will ultimately, to your point, transform this tired, old, hierarchical command and control management style that no longer serves us into a more purposeful, more humanistic, more collaborative leadership approach for the benefit of all stakeholders. And I say our stakeholders are these four, and like the four circle Venn diagram, they overlap. Our teammates, we want to create a better place to work. Our customers, we want to create a better buying experience. And we know that better teammates who are motivated, engaged, are going to take better care of our customers, that are going to then throw off more of a return on investment for our business partners, not just our investors, but anybody in our business ecosystem. It could be our supplier partners, our distribution partners, our warehouse partners, our agency partners, whoever helps us fulfill our brand promise, right? And then the fourth stakeholder that often gets overlooked is our communities. And so now we talk about purpose. If we are engaged in our communities, beyond just making a profit, it's purpose and profit, not or. They're not mutually exclusive. And in the book, I cite several examples of companies who are doing well by doing good. And think of that virtuous cycle of reciprocity. If you are a purposeful company, you're going to attract and retain and engage better quality teammates, right? And if you have all those, then you're going to give, again, a better customer experience that's going to make them want to come back to you, buy more from you, and speak well of you. And in this age of social media, we know that social review is really big part of a buying decision now, more so than ever before. And then you're going to, again, make more profit for all of your business partners, and then you're going to be able to do more good in your community. Wash, rinse, and repeat, right? And that is why I am this kind of Pied Piper leading the purposeful growth revolution, by showing people that encouraging a leadership style of love at work will help you be more profitable. It's not some airy, fairy, cotton candy, namby, pamby, seal loving, tree hugging, you know, woke agenda. It's about being human, right? And if you are a human and treating others like fellow humans, you're going to get better work. And when you get better work, you're going to get better results. And everybody, each of those four stakeholders wins.
I want to point out that everything that you mentioned, like the whole kind of storytelling of it, every single piece of it started with humility. And that's incredible, because, you know, you start with teaching someone something. And even that, like, if you don't start there, then how are you going to do good to do well, you know?
Right.
You know, all that I just don't think exists without some humility and some compassion, and maybe just kind of dropping your pride a little bit and saying, hey, yep, can you help? And maybe in turn, this can help you. Yep. But I think too many people don't want to even start there because they don't want to seem weak. So
yeah,
they think that every leader has to be super strong all the time, or else they're not going to be respected. And I think that's just insecurities coming out. And I just think that, you know, like you said, you help someone and they become the next generation of leaders. But I don't think a lot of people want that. I think they're too selfish for that. They don't want to be surpassed. They don't want someone to know everything that they have, because they think that, hey, my value will diminish if other people are in on my secrets and my philosophies and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, you used the right word, insecurity, right? But I want to pick up on the word you started with, which is humility. And so for me, I believe that servant leadership is the best form of leadership. Because now it says, you don't work for me, I actually work for you. Think of it that way, invert it, right? And how can I serve you, Michael, as a member of my team? How can I help you be the very best at your role? And so that's why I believe words matter. I don't like the word employee or worker or staffer or, God forbid, FTE, we're human beings. And I come from a sports background. And I used to say, oh, instead of employee, I prefer team member. And I think that's not a bad thing. A team member is someone who has a role, defined role they play on the team. But I prefer teammate because that suggests not only do you play your role, but you help others play their role better, right? And so I think about this idea of humility as a way to be a better servant leader. So you think about service and humility are the two fundamental building blocks of being a great servant leader. And to your point about insecurity, yes, that's part of the human condition, right? I'm Pollyannish enough to think that, you know, someone's going to read this book and it's going to change everything. But what it will do is start as a catalytic event. And things happen over time, but it always takes a catalytic event to spark a movement. And we're already seeing it among the younger generation. And some of the old dogs, like I said, if they don't want to learn new tricks, some of them are saying, well, I'll just wait it out and retire. Well, okay, then you're like, that's what you're going to do, and we're not going to get to you, right? But when they start falling off, that's when a new generation of leaders kicks in. And over time, we are going to transform the command and control management style that no longer serves us into a more purposeful, relational, more collaborative, humanistic leadership approach that will benefit all stakeholders. And I believe leaders can change the world. I believe leaders are the only people who can. And if you think about some of the ills that face our world today, you know, geopolitically, governmentally, societally, technologically, and all of it hits us personally and professionally. Well, there's four letters at the end of each of the word I just used that are A-L-L-Y. And I began to think about things like this. And I say, well, we need an ally to help us blow past those headwinds that are facing us that I just mentioned, right? How do you grow in an environment where all those things are stacked against you? There has to be a catalytic event that can start the transformation that leads to a movement where this becomes just the way business is done today. So visionary person says, you know, what's the world as it exists today versus the world that I envision that I believe everybody would benefit from? And how do we start to move toward that world? And it's like the old adage, how do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time, right? It's impacting one leader on one team that then has a ripple effect, that then has another leader on another team that gets it and has, you know, the old dogs who are dying off, you know, fine. You go into retirement and enjoy your fishing or whatever you do, right? But now leave, you know, the younger generation to be in charge of building a new work environment in this new world of work with all those headwinds facing us. We can't keep doing the same thing the old way and expecting a different result.
As a young man, I would say I also really appreciate the command and controllers for showing us how not to do it.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that experience. You know, you said, I feel so bad for you about the that boss you had. I'm grateful. Yes, I was pissed off in the moment for sure, but I'm so grateful because that just kind of made me say, you know what? He's like this, and he's successful doing his own thing somewhat. So if I do my own thing, and I take all these principles I've learned, the good, the bad, the ugly, and I apply them to my new business, how could I not succeed? Especially if I lead with empathy, and I try to form good connections, and you know, things like this podcast, like connecting with people like you. How else would I have done connected with you or anyone else that provides insight like this if it wasn't for the snowball effect of me having empathy with other people and them saying, hey, Michael's decent enough guy for you to be on his podcast. You want to do it? So it's just the snowball effect is humbling in a great way. It's like a blessing. And everything you just described is just spot on. So I appreciate you sharing all that.
Yeah. And thank you for giving me this platform, Michael, because what you're doing is a mighty work. You are exposing people to new ideas, new concepts, ways they can grow and learn. And you know, I believe Einstein said, when you stop learning, you start dying. And I also take that to heart and say, I want to have a growth mindset, not, you know, someone who just always just, I want to be better at what I'm really comfortable doing, and I don't really want to learn anything new. That's, you know, that's not going to get you anywhere, right? You'll hit a ceiling, and you'll keep hitting ceilings, and you'll taking other jobs, and you'll hit a ceiling because you weren't willing to have a growth mindset, to be uncomfortable. And that's a really important thing. And there's another quote I love from a gal named Gina Milicic, who says, a comfort zone is a beautiful place, but nothing ever grows there. And that has stuck with me. And so, you know, writing my first book was the hardest thing I'd ever done. Like I said, I didn't grow up being a writer or an author, and never thought I would do it. But I felt that epiphany that was given to me. I wanted to be faithful to fulfill it. But the other part that drives me is the pain of regret. How would I feel years later if I didn't finish what was given to me and didn't fulfill that vision that I had early on? And while it took me about 8 or 9 years, the first book, because I didn't, again, fancy myself an author, I let FUD get in the way. And I have a chapter in that first book that says, get the FUD out. And it stands for fear, uncertainty, doubt, and delay.
Yeah.
The fear of what if it's not any good? The uncertainty of if I'm willing to give up a fairly comfortable C-level W-2, you know, career to do something like I'm doing now as a solopreneur. The doubts that creep in like wet cement that begin to harden, like, well, no one knows who you are. You're not some rock star CEO or huge influencer. Why would someone want to care to learn from you? That then leads to delay, right? I just give myself a shot of dopamine to make me feel good for the moment, and I'll pick it up later. And I did that for several years in between jobs or on a vacation or getting up on a Saturday morning, and I kept working on it, kept working on it. Before I had enough material, I'm like, this really could be a book. And I got it done. And I'm telling you, Michael, when that first edition from Amazon, the test book, hit my front door and I opened it up, it had my name on it, there was not a better feeling in the world. And then when it hit bestseller status a few months later, when I launched it, it was so validating. And yet, for so many years, I carried the FUD with me. And so the anecdote that I write in the book, and I didn't have it figured out until I was working on that chapter, and I said, well, I can't just leave it at here's what that means. What's the anecdote? Well, faith overcomes fear. Hope of a richly imagined future can overcome uncertainty. Belief not only in a higher power, but belief in yourself, can overcome the doubts. And then really important, action, indeed purposeful action, can overcome the paralysis of delay. And it hit me, and I worked on finishing that chapter based on my own experiences and the anecdote that I found to FUD. So I hope that's helpful for you or your listeners. Some of you, like yourself, you now you're going into entrepreneurship, you've left kind of a sales career, and you may have FUD. That's okay. It's part of the human condition, right? But instead of having fear, have faith. Have faith that you have a big idea and that you can overcome whatever obstacles are thrown in your way. Instead of feeling uncertain about it, yeah, you're going to feel uncertain. But remember that hope, that richly imagined future that you imagine for yourself or your family. And instead of having those doubts that no one, you know, what do I have new to contribute? No one knows who I am. Have a belief. A belief in yourself that you might have a different spin on something that the world is missing and waiting for. And then again, instead of delaying it, because it's easy to say, well, someday I'll do that. I have this big idea, but I don't want to leave my job to go do it because I don't know if it's going to work. Well, take purposeful action. What can you do today? Not a week from now, not 2 weeks from now, but what even small step can you do today that takes you toward your goal?
Yeah, no, that's I definitely think that there are people who listen to God and listen to, you know, that epiphany or, you know, whatever it may be, and they do it, and they say, you know, I have enough money to retire, but that's not what this is about. There's more I can offer. And then there's people who don't. And I think even for, you know, a young guy like me starting off a new career in entrepreneurship, yes, I'm taking meaningful action and stuff, but I almost feel that it helps me to tell myself, who cares if you're delusional right now? Let's go.
Yeah.
And I love that, because delusional always has a negative context, but not for me right now. Because even if, and maybe I'm not, but if I tell myself that when fear creeps up and everything creeps up and everything says, why would you do this? Why would you, like, just go back? Then delusion is what I like to lean on, and it helps a lot. So,
well, think of all of the tremendous accomplishments that entrepreneurs have made. You know, I mentioned Bill Gates, right? Someone in his garage who's tinkering with, you know, electronics and has this vision for creating a personal computer. And, you know, I don't know if it was, you know, Henry Ford, who forever wanted to have a combustible gas powered engine to drive an automobile, right? And he kept at it, and he kept at it, and he kept at it, right? And countless examples of people that had the vision, but had this internal drive and this resilience. A good friend of mine's wife told me last summer when I was finishing my second book, she said, Mark, one thing I admire about you is you have dogged perseverance. And I thought, how perfect. I will run through a brick wall, and when I bounce back, I'll try again. And when I bounce back, I'll try again, maybe because I have a hard head. But it's because I have a burning desire to accomplish a goal, and nothing is going to stop me from accomplishing that goal. And what I'm hearing from you, Michael, is you, at even a younger age, have a bit of a fearlessness that is a positive trait, right? Not recklessness, there's a difference, but fearlessness is an admirable trait for you and all of your listeners or viewers to embody, to say, you know, this little, you know, saying in a restaurant that I found years ago when I was living in Dallas, where you are, Palomino was a restaurant, and it had these little cards, and they gave you almost like a fortune cookie. And I opened it up, and mine said, "What great thing would you accomplish if you knew you could not fail?" And I kept it with me all these years.
Wow.
Because it really spoke to me. What great thing would you accomplish if you knew you could not fail? And so having this mindset that I can't fail, I won't let myself fail, right? But I'll get the help I need, so it's not just me. And I did. When I wrote the book, I got to be part of an author group that had accountability partners. I got to learn about you know, the publishing world and how to find, you know, a cover artist and interior designer and how to find editors and how to find publishers and all of the things I didn't know. I knew the content that I was writing, but I didn't know what I didn't know. And instead of letting that stop me, I reached out for help because I was bound and determined to accomplish this goal that I felt was given to me.
Yeah. And I think, one of the things I hate, just to kind of close this out, is I hate when people just say, just do your best. If it doesn't work, it's fine. I'm like, no, that I don't agree with that because of what you just said, too. If you don't know and you already have done your best, then reach out for help.
Right.
So there's always someone who hasn't done their best that could help you, and maybe they will for you. So
yep.
I appreciate that insight. And Mark, thank you so much for everything. I have three questions for you before we close out.
Sure.
One, where can our listeners find your book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and you can get it as, if you're a digital person, you can get it as an ebook. Even if you don't have Kindle, you can get it as an ebook. You can get it as a paperback, and I even have a hardcover if you're someone who really wants something on your bookshelf that'll last a while. And then the other way to get in touch with me is LinkedIn. You know, you can follow me, I'll follow you, we'll get connected, because I want to learn from you. And I have this monthly newsletter called Seeds for Growth. You can sign up for that if that's something that you are interested in based on our conversation. And right now, I think I have over 2,500 subscribers and the list is growing. And so it is a ripple effect that allows me to get this word out. And then finally, my website is markamears.com. You got to put the A in there. I couldn't get markbeers.com. The domain was already taken. So it's not like I'm being pretentious, like I have some famous middle name. I don't. It's Alan. but markamears.com. And there you can take the same assessment that you just took. And then you can learn a little bit more about how we might work together if you are interested.
Awesome. Thank you. And so next question, what's your favorite book other than your own?
You can't see behind me, but I've got not only bookshelves full of books, I've got books in boxes that I haven't been able to unpack. And so it's tough to pinpoint one book. What would it be? One book. I'll give you an honest answer that was the input for why I wrote the first book. It was called Halftime by Bob Buford. And his thesis and the subtitle, which is what I wish I would have written, is Moving from Success to Significance. And his thesis was the first part of your life and career, it's about accumulation, it's about climbing the ladder. And then when you get to a certain point, it's about giving back. And that really resonated with me. And I thought, well, what if I were giving back earlier in my career? What more impact could I have made instead of it being all about me, 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 and my family and my career and all that? What if I was a bit more like I've become over time, someone who isn't just a taker, but a giver? And there's a second book by Adam Grant called Give and Take, which is analogous to that book. So I'll throw both of those out there. Bob Buford's Halftime, and then Adam Grant's Give and Take.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark. And I actually added two more questions after this one. But who is the most famous contact in your phone?
Famous contact? Wow. In my phone, I'm going to say my good friend Ken Caldwell. And he, you might not know the name, but you would know the work. We worked together at Pizza Hut several years ago and become, you know, great friends, to where he wrote the foreword in my new book. And he has served, when he left Pizza Hut, he actually was the kind of father of stuffed crust pizza. For those of you who like stuffed crust pizza, he nice. The development team he worked on came up with that. And that was a big claim to fame for him. He went on to become a marketing executive, a CMO at Wendy's, Domino's, and then was the CEO at Papa Murphy's. Well, that's not what makes him notable. He left that to go be a CMO at Compassion International that helps serve kids all around the world who are needy. And then most recently, he kind of served in an advisor capacity, was brought on as CEO of Come Near, which is the organization that created the He Gets Us campaign that you may see ads during the Super Bowl or maybe other places now. And I admire the heck out of them, because not only that, but he overcame a horrific bike accident where he and another friend of mine got hit by a car years and years ago. And, he had just life-threatening injuries and was pieced together like a bit of an erector set. And then got back on the bike and has just continued to live his life in a way that I admire, with his faith and not only his intellect, but his ability with compassion, with humility, to lead in a way that I've always admired. And so I think that's famous to me.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. What is the best way to find a mentor if you're a young guy like me looking to seek guidance, like we talked about, whenever you need help?
Well, if you're in a company, there are people, maybe not even in your area. When I was at Pizza Hut years ago, there was a guy named Pat Williamson who was head of operations. I'm in marketing, right? So we wouldn't interact all that often, but we had a workout facility and we'd be down in the workout facility and he'd be on the bike or I'd be on the treadmill, and after a break, we'd talk about different things. And it got to be a thing where, I would ask him a question and he'd invite me to lunch. And one thing led to another, and it wasn't a formal mentoring kind of thing. You can do those, but this was a little bit more informal. And it became part of me reaching out to him by asking a question. And him, seeing that I had interest in learning and growing, wanted to give back. And so the relationship grew, and I'm still very tight with Pat to this very day. And that's been years ago. And so you can find a mentor if you're willing to open up your eyes and take an initiative and ask a question. And you don't come out and say, "Will you be my mentor?" But it starts with a conversation. And when they see you're interested, people want to invest in people who have an interest in learning and growing. I get, as a leader, all day long for people who come to me with questions. And I'm standing there engaged. I'm seeing that they want to learn. And now I can invest even more of my efforts and time into their success.
Yeah. Yeah, I just had Brian Biro on my podcast last week. And we talked about how whenever you're focused on other people, life is just so much better, you know?
Amen, brother. I'm telling you, it's again, the insecurity that gets us to think that I've got to protect, I got to survive, it's about me. When you break that down and go back to that little kind of, fortune cookie saying, and what great thing would you accomplish if you knew you could not fail? Well, you can't fail. If the only way you can fail is if you fail to try. And that's why I hate the word failure, because for me, you only fail if you fail to try. And someone once said, may have been Nelson Mandela. He said, either I win or I learn. I love that, because you don't fail. Because if you do something and it doesn't work, right, you could look at that as a failure if you stop then. But if you then say, what can I learn about what didn't work and how can I do it better next time? Then it's about growth. Growth happens through a variety of different iterations. And if you look at them as failures, you're not seeing the bigger picture that those are learning opportunities.
Yeah. Thank you for that. To finish out a fun one, are you a watch guy?
No, but people admire my watch, and nice. It's both gold and silver. And I got it when we were living in LA several years ago. And I liked the fact that it was two-tone. I could wear it with anything. And I've had it for a number of years because it's faithful. It keeps time and allows me to get where I'm going, hopefully on time. But I have a couple of friends that are really into watches, and they could tell you every different aspect of every different kind of watch. And for me, I'm more about, just tell me what time it is. I don't need to know, how the watch works.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure having you on, and I think this episode's going to be a hit. So, I think we're going to reach the people that need to be reached. So I appreciate it. Mark Mears, everyone.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure getting to know you, and I hope we can stay in touch and we can mentor each other.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Thank you.
Have a great day.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces, hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.